Emergency announcement. There is a small party of Bleakmen out on the open desert at gyro compass point 4.65003, dying from exposure and lack of water. Ships north of Lewistown are instructed to direct their flights to that point with all possible speed and give assistance. United Nations law requires all commercial and private ships to respond. The announcement was repeated in the crisp voice of the UN announcer, speaking from the UN transmitter on the artificial satellite somewhere overhead. Feeling the copter alter its course, Arnie said, "Aw, come on, my boy." "I have to respond, sir," the pilot said. "It's the law." "Christ's sake," Arnie thought with disgust. He made a mental note to have the boy sacked, or at least suspended, as soon as they got back from their trip. Now they were above the desert, moving at good speed toward the intersect which the UN announcer had given. "Bleakmen niggers," Arnie thought. "We have to drop everything we're doing to bail them out, the damn fools. Can't they trot across their own desert? Haven't they been doing it without our help for 5,000 years? As Jack Boland started to lower his Yee Company repair ship toward McAuliffe's dairy ranch below, he heard the UN announcer come on with the emergency notification, the like of which Boland had heard many times before and which never failed to chill him. "Party of Bleakmen out on the open desert," the matter-of-fact voice declared. "Dying from exposure and lack of water. Ships north of Lewistown." "I've got it," Jack Boland said to himself. He cut his mic on and said, "Yee Company repair ship close by gyro compass point 4.65003, ready to respond at once. Should reach them in 2 or 3 minutes. He swung his copter south, away from McAuliffe's ranch, getting a golden moment sort of satisfaction at the thought of McAuliffe's indignation right now as he saw the copter swing away and guessed the reason. No one had less use for the Bleakmen than did the big ranchers. The poverty-stricken nomadic natives were constantly showing up at the ranches for food, water, medical help, and sometimes just a plain old-fashioned handout. And nothing seemed to madden the prosperous dairymen more than to be used by the creatures whose land they had appropriated. Another copter was responding now. The pilot was saying, "I'm just outside Lewistown at gyro compass point 4.78995, and will respond as soon as possible. I have rations aboard, including 50 gallons of water." He gave his identification and then rang off. The dairy ranch with its cows fell away to the north, and Jack Boland was gazing intently down at the open desert once more, seeking to catch sight of the party of Bleakmen. Sure enough, there they were, 5 of them in the shade cast by a small hill of stone. They were not moving. Possibly they were already dead. The UN satellite, in its swing across the sky, had discovered them, and yet it could not help them. Their mentors were powerless. "And we who can help them, what do we care?" Jack thought. The Bleakmen were dying out anyhow, the remnants getting more tattered and despairing every year. They were wards of the UN, protected by them. Some protection, Jack thought. But what could be done for a waning race? Time had run out for the natives of Mars long before the first Soviet ship had appeared in the sky with its television cameras grinding away back in the 60s. No human group had conspired to exterminate them. It had not been necessary. And anyhow, they had been a vast curiosity at first. Here was a discovery worth the billions spent in the task of reaching Mars. Here was an extraterrestrial race. He landed the copter on the flat sand close by the party of Bleakmen, switched off the blades, opened the door, and stepped out. The hot morning sun beat down on him as he walked across the sand toward the unmoving Bleakmen. They were alive. They had their eyes open and were watching him. "Rains are falling from me onto your valuable persons," he called to them, the proper Bleakmen greeting in the Bleaky dialect. Close to them now, he saw that the party consisted of one wrinkled old couple, a young male and female, no doubt husband and wife, and their infant. A family, obviously, which had set out across the desert alone on foot, probably seeking water or food. Perhaps the oasis at which they had been subsisting had dried up. It was typical of the plight of the Bleakmen, this conclusion to their trek. Here they lay, unable to go on any farther. They had withered away to something resembling heaps of dried vegetable matter, and they would have died soon had not the UN satellite spotted them. Rising to his feet slowly, the young Bleakmen male genuflected and said in a wavering, frail voice, "The rains falling from your wonderful presence invigorate and restore us, mister." Jack Boland tossed his canteen to the young Bleakmen, who at once knelt down, unscrewed the cap, and gave it to the supine elderly couple. The old lady seized it and drank from it. The change in her came at once. She seemed to swell back into life, to change from the muddy gray color of death before his eyes.
"May we fill our eggshells?"
the young Bleakman male asked Jack. Lying upright on the sand were several paca eggs, pale, hollow shells which Jack saw were completely empty. The Bleakman transported water in these shells. Their technical ability was so slight that they did not even possess clay pots. And yet, he reflected, their ancestors had constructed the great canal system. "Sure," he said. "There's another ship coming with plenty of water." He went back to his copter and got his lunch pail. Returning with it, he handed it to the Bleakman male. "Food," he explained, as if they didn't know. Already the elderly couple were on their feet, tottering up with their hands stretched out. Behind Jack, the roar of a second copter grew louder. It was landing, a big two-person copter that now coasted up and halted, its blades slowly spinning. The pilot called down, "Do you need me? If not, I'll go on."
"I don't have much water for them," Jack said.
"Okay," the pilot said and switched off his blades. He hopped out, lugging a 5-gallon can. "They can have this." Together, Jack and the pilot stood watching the Bleakman filling their eggshells from the can of water. Their possessions were not many. A quiver of poisoned arrows and animal hide for each of them. The two women had their pounding blocks, their sole possessions of value. Without the blocks, they were not fit women, for on them they prepared either meat or grain, whatever food their hunt might bring. And they had a few cigarettes.
"My passenger," the young pilot said in a low voice in Jack's ear, "isn't too keen about the UN being able to compel us to stop like this. But what he doesn't realize is that they've got that satellite up there and they can see if we fail to stop, and it's a hell of a big fine."
Jack turned and looked up into the parked copter. He saw seated inside it a heavy-set man with a bald head, a well-fed, self-satisfied-looking man who gazed out sourly, paying no attention to the 5 Bleakmen.
"You have to comply with the law," the pilot said in a defensive voice. "It'd be me who they'd sock with the fine."
Walking over to the ship, Jack called up to the big bald-headed man seated within. "Doesn't it make you feel good to know you saved the lives of 5 people?" The bald-headed man looked down at him and said, "5 niggers, you mean? I don't call that saving 5 people, do you?"
"Yeah, I do," Jack said, "and I intend to continue doing so."
"Go ahead, call it that," the bald-headed man said.
Flushing, he glanced over at Jack's copter, read the markings on it.
"See where it gets you."
Coming over beside Jack, the young pilot said hurriedly, "That's Arnie you're talking to, Arnie Cott." He called up, "We can leave now, Arnie." Climbing up, the pilot disappeared inside the copter, and once more the blades began to turn. The copter rose into the air, leaving Jack standing alone by the 5 Bleakmen. They had now finished drinking and were eating from the lunch pail which he had given them. The empty water can lay off to one side. The paca eggshells had been filled and were now stoppered. The Bleakmen did not glance up as the copter left. They paid no attention to Jack, either. They murmured among themselves in their dialect.
"What's your destination?" Jack asked them.
The young Bleakman named an oasis very far to the south.
"You think you can make it?" Jack asked.
He pointed to the old couple. "Can they?"
"Yes, mister," the young Bleakman answered. "We can make it now with the food and water yourself and the other mister gave us."
"I wonder if they can," Jack said to himself. Naturally, they'd say it, even if they knew it wasn't possible. Racial pride, I guess.
"Mister," the young Bleakman said, "we have a present for you because you stopped."
He held out something to Jack. Their possessions were so meager that he could not believe they had anything to spare. He held his hand out, however, and the young Bleakman put something small and cold into it, a dark, wrinkled, dried bit of substance that looked to Jack like a section of tree root.
"It is a water witch," the Bleakman said. "Mister, it will bring you water, the source of life, any time you need."
"It didn't help you, did it?" Jack said. With a sly smile, the young Bleakman said,
"Mister, it helped. It brought you."
"What'll you do without it?" Jack asked.
"We have another, mister. We fashion water witches."
The young Bleakman pointed to the old couple.
"They are authorities."
More carefully examining the water witch, Jack saw that it had a face and vague limbs. It was mummified. Once a living creature of some sort.
He made out its drawn-up legs, its ears. He shivered. The face was oddly human, a wizened, suffering face, as if it had been killed while crying out. "How does it work?" he asked the young bleakman.
"Formerly, when one wanted water, one pissed on the water witch and she came to life. Now we do not do that, mister. We have learned from you, mistress, that to piss is wrong. So we spit on her instead, and she hears that too almost as well. It wakes her, and she opens and looks around, and then she opens her mouth and calls the water to her, as she did with you, mister, and that other mister, the big one who sat and did not come down, the mister with no hair on his head."
"That mister is a powerful mister," Jack said. "He's a monarch of the Plumbers Union settlement, and he owns all of Lewistown."
"That may be," the young bleakman said. "If so, we will not stop at Lewistown, because we could see that the mister with no hair did not like us.
We did not give him a water witch in return for his water, because he did not want to give us water. His heart was not with him in that deed. It came from his hands only."
Jack said goodbye to the bleakman and got back into his copter. A moment later he was ascending. Below him, the bleakman waved solemnly. "I'll give the water witch to David," he decided, "when I get home at the end of the week. He can piss on it or spit on it, whichever he prefers, to his heart's content." Chapter 3 Norbert Steiner had a certain freedom to come and go as he pleased, because he was self-employed. In a small iron building outside of Bunchwood Park, he manufactured health foods, made entirely from domestic plants and minerals, with no preservatives or chemical sprays or non-organic attractive fertilizers. A firm at Bunchwood Park packaged his products for him in professional-type boxes, cartons, jars, and envelopes, and then Steiner drove about Mars, selling them direct to the consumer. His profit was fair, because after all he had no competition. His was the sole health food business on Mars. And then, too, he had a sideline. He imported from Earth various gourmet food items, such as truffles, goose-liver pâté, caviar, kangaroo tail soup, Danish blue cheese, smoked oysters, quail eggs, rum babas, all of which were illegal on Mars, due to the attempt by the UN to force the colonies to become self-sufficient foods-wise. The UN food experts claimed that it was unsafe to transport food across space due to the chance of harmful radiation contaminating it, but Steiner knew better. The actual reason was their fear of the consequences to the colonies in case of war back home. Food shipments would cease, and unless the colonies were self-sufficient, they probably would starve themselves out of existence within a short time. While he admired their reasoning, Steiner did not wish to acquiesce in fact. A few cans of French truffles imported on the sly would not cause the dairy ranchers to stop trying to produce milk, nor the hog, steer, and sheep ranchers from keeping on with the struggle to make their farms pay. Apple and peach and apricot trees would still be planted and tended, sprayed and watered, even if glass jars of caviar showed up in the various settlements at $20 each. At this moment, Steiner was inspecting a shipment of tins of halva, a Turkish pastry, which had arrived the night before, aboard the self-guiding ship which shuttled between Manila and the tiny field in the wastelands of the FDR Mountains which Steiner had constructed, using bleakmen as laborers. Halva sold well, especially in New Israel, and Steiner, inspecting the tins for signs of damage, estimated that he could get at least $5 for each one. And then also old Arnie Cott at Lewistown took almost anything sweet that Steiner could lay his hands on, plus cheeses and canned fish of every kind, not to mention the Canadian smoked bacon which showed up in 5-pound tins, the same as Dutch hams. In fact, Arnie Cott was his best single customer. The storage shed where Steiner now sat lay within sight of his small private illegal landing field. Upright on the field stood the rocket which had come in last night. Steiner's technician, he himself had no manual ability of any sort, was busy preparing it for its return flight to Manila. The rocket was small, only 20 feet high, but it was Swiss-made and quite stable. Above, the ruddy Martian sun cast elongated shadows from the peaks of the surrounding range, and Steiner had turned on a kerosene heater to warm his storage shed. The technician, seeing Steiner look out through the window of the shed, nodded to indicate that the rocket was ready for its return load, so Steiner put down his tins of halva temporarily. Taking hold of the hand truck, he began pushing the load of cartons through the doorway of the shed and out onto the rocky ground. "That looks like over 100 pounds, his technician said critically as Steiner came up pushing the hand truck. "Very light cartons," Steiner said.
They contained a dried grass, which back in the Philippines was processed in such a way that the end result very much resembled hashish. It was smoked in a mixture with ordinary Virginia Burley tobacco and got a terrific price in the United States. Steiner had never tried the stuff himself. To him, physical and moral health were one. He believed in his health foods, and neither smoked nor drank. Together, he and Otto loaded the rocket with its cargo, sealed it, and then Otto set the guidance system's clock. In a few days, Jose Pizquito back home at Manila would be unloading the cargo, going over the order form included, and assembling Steiner's needs for the return trip. "Will you fly me back with you?" Otto asked. "I'm going first to New Israel," Steiner said. "That's okay. I've got plenty of time." On his own, Otto Zitti had once operated a small black market business. He dealt exclusively in electronic equipment, components of great fragility and small size, which were smuggled in aboard the common carriers operating between Earth and Mars. And at former times he had tried to import such prized black market items as typewriters, cameras, tape recorders, furs, and whiskey. But their competition had driven him out. Trade in those necessities of life, selling on a mass basis throughout the colonies, had been taken over by the big professional black market operators who had enormous capital to back them up and their own full-scale transportation system. And anyhow, Otto's heart was not in it. He wanted to be a repairman. In fact, he had come to Mars for that purpose, not knowing that two or three firms monopolized the repair business, operating like exclusive guilds, such as the Yee Company, for whom Steiner's neighbor, Jack Bolin, worked. Otto had taken the aptitude tests, but he was not good enough. Therefore, after a year or so on Mars, he had turned to working for Steiner and running his small import operation. It was humiliating for him, but at least he was not doing manual labor on one of the colony's work gangs out under the sun reclaiming the desert. As Otto and Steiner walked back to the storage shed, Steiner said, "I personally can't stand those Israelis, even though I have to deal with them all the time. They're unnatural the way they live, in those barracks and always out trying to plant orchards, oranges or lemons, you know. They have the advantage over everybody else because back home they lived almost like we live here, with desert and hardly any resources." "True," Otto said, "but you have to hand it to them. They really hustle. They're not lazy." "And not only that," Steiner said, "they're hypocrites regarding food. Look at how many cans of non-kosher meat they buy from me. None of them keep the dietary laws." "Well, if you don't approve of them buying smoked oysters from you, don't sell to them," Otto said. "It's their business, not mine," Steiner said. He had another reason for visiting New Israel, a reason which even Otto did not know about. A son of Steiner's lived there, in a special camp for what were called anomalous children. The term referred to any child who differed from the norm, either physically or psychologically, to the extent that he could not be educated in the public school. Steiner's son was autistic, and for 3 years the instructor at the camp had been working with him, trying to bring him into communication with the human culture into which he had been born. To have an autistic child was a special shame, because the psychologists believed that the condition came from a defect in the parents, usually a schizoid temperament. Manfred Steiner, aged 10, had never spoken a word. He ran about on tiptoe, avoiding people as if they were things, sharp-pointed and dangerous. Physically, he was a large, healthy, blonde-haired boy, and for the first year or so, the Steiners had rejoiced in having him. But now, even the instructor at Camp BG could offer little hope. And the instructor was always optimistic. It was her job. "I may be in New Israel all day," Steiner said, as he and Otto loaded the cans of halva into the copter. "I have to visit every damn kibbutz in the place, and that takes hours." "Why don't you want me along?" Otto demanded with hot anger. Steiner shuffled his feet, hung his head, and said guiltily, "You misunderstand. I'd love to have company, but..." For an instant, he thought of telling Otto the truth. "I'll take you to the tractor bus terminal and drop you off, okay?" He felt weary. When he got to Camp BG, he would find Manfred just the same, never meeting anyone's eye, always darting about on the periphery, more like a taut, wary animal than a child. It was hardly worth going, but still he would go. In his own mind, Steiner blamed it all on his wife. When Manfred was a baby, she had never talked to him or shown him any affection. Having been trained as a chemist, she had an intellectual matter-of-fact attitude, inappropriate in a mother. She had bathed and fed the baby as if he were a laboratory animal, like a white rat. She kept him clean and healthy, but she had never sung to him, laughed with him, had not really used language to or with him. So naturally, he had become autistic. What else could he do? Steiner, thinking about it, felt grim. So much for marrying a woman with a master's degree. When he thought of the Boland boy next door, yelling and playing. But look at Sylvia Boland. She was a genuine mother and woman, vital, physically attractive, alive. True, she was domineering and selfish. She had a highly developed sense of what was hers. But he admired her for that. She was not sentimental. She was strong. For instance, consider the water question and her attitude. It was not possible to break her down, even by alleging that his own water tank had leaked out their 2 weeks' supply. Thinking about that, Steiner smiled ruefully. Sylvia Boland hadn't been taken in, not even for a moment. Otto said, "Drop me off at the bus terminal, then." With relief, Steiner said, "Good enough, and you won't have to endure those Israelis." Eyeing him, Otto said, "I told you, Norbert, I don't mind them." Together, they entered the copter, and Steiner seated himself at the controls and started the engine. He said nothing more to Otto. As he set his copter down at Weizmann Field, north of New Israel, Steiner felt guilty that he had talked badly about the Israelis. He had done it only as part of his speech designed to dissuade Otto from coming along with him, but nevertheless it was not right. It went contrary to his authentic feelings. Shame, he realized. That was why he had said it. Shame because of his defective son at Camp BG. What a powerful drive it was. It could make a man say anything. Without the Israelis, his son would be uncared for. No other facilities for anomalous children existed on Mars, although there were dozens of such institutions back home, as was every other facility one could think of. And the cost of keeping Manfred at the camp was so low as to be a mere formality. As he parked his copter and got out, Steiner felt his guilt grow until he wondered how he could face the Israelis. It seemed to him that, God forbid, they might be able to read his mind, might somehow intuit what he had said about them when he was elsewhere. However, the Israeli field personnel greeted him pleasantly, and his guilt began to fade. Evidently, it did not show after all. Lugging his heavy suitcases, he crossed the field to the parking lot where the tractor bus waited to take passengers into the central business district. He had already boarded the bus and was making himself comfortable when he remembered that he had not brought any present for his son. Miss Milch, the instructor, had told him always to bring a gift, a durable object by which Manfred could recall his father after he had left. "I'll just have to stop somewhere," Steiner said to himself. "Buy a toy, a game, perhaps." And then he remembered that one of the parents who visited her child at Camp BG ran a gift shop in New Israel, Mrs. Esterhazy. He could stop there. Mrs. Esterhazy had seen Manfred and understood about the anomalous children in general. She would know what to give him, and there would be no embarrassing questions such as, "How old is the boy?" At the stop nearest the gift shop, he got off the bus and walked up the sidewalk, enjoying the sight of small, well-kept stores and offices. New Israel in many ways reminded him of home. It was a true city, more so than Bunchwood Park itself or Lewistown. Many people could be seen, most of them hurrying as if they had business to conduct, and he drank in the atmosphere of commerce and activity. He came to the gift shop with its modern sign and sloping glass windows. Except for the Martian shrub growing in the window box, it could have been a store in downtown Berlin. He entered and found Mrs. Esterhazy standing at the counter, smiling as she recognized him. She was an attractive, matronly woman in her early 40s, with dark hair and always well-dressed, always looking fresh and intelligent. As everyone knew, Mrs. Esterhazy was terribly active in civic affairs and politics. She put out a newsletter and belonged to one committee after another. That she had a child in Camp BG. That was a secret, known only to a few of the other parents and, of course, the staff at the camp. It was a young child, only 3, suffering from one of the formidable physical defects associated with exposure to gamma rays during its intrauterine existence. He had seen it only once. There were many sobering anomalies at Camp BG, and he had come to accept them, whatever they looked like. At first it had startled him, the Esterhazy child. It was so small and shriveled, with enormous eyes like a lemur's. It had peculiar webbed fingers, as if it had been fashioned for an aquatic world. He had the feeling about it that it was astonishingly acute in its perceptions. It had studied him with deep intensity, seeming to reach some depth in him usually inaccessible, perhaps even to himself. It had seemed to reach out somehow and probe his secrets, and then it had withdrawn, accepting him on the basis of what it had picked up. The child, he had surmised, was a Martian, that is, born on Mars, to Mrs. Esterhazy and some man who was not her husband, since she no longer had a husband. That fact he had picked up from her in conversation. She announced it calmly, making no bones about it. She had been divorced for a number of years. Obviously, then, the child at Camp PG had been born out of wedlock, but Mrs. Esterhazy, like so many modern women, did not consider that a disgrace. Steiner shared her opinion. Setting down his heavy suitcases, Steiner said, "What a nice little shop you have here, Mrs. Esterhazy." "Thank you," she said, coming around from behind the counter. "What can I do for you, Mr. Steiner? Are you here to sell me yogurt and wheat germ?" Her dark eyes twinkled. "I need a present for Manfred," Steiner said. A soft, compassionate expression appeared on her face. "I see. Well." She moved away from him, toward one of the counters. "I saw your son the other day when I was visiting BG. Has he shown any interest in music? Often autistic children enjoy music."
"He's fond of drawing. He paints pictures all the time."
She picked up a small wooden flute-like instrument.
"This is locally made, and very well made, too."
She held it out to him.
"Yes," he said, "I'll take this."
"Miss Milch is utilizing music as a method of reaching the autistic children at BG," Mrs. Esterhazy said as she went to wrap up the wooden flute. "The dance in particular." She hesitated, then, "Mr. Steiner, you know that I'm in constant touch with the political scene back home. There's a rumor that the UN is considering..." She lowered her voice, her face pale.
"I do so hate to inflict suffering on you, Mr. Steiner, but if there is any truth in this, and there certainly seems to be..."
"Go ahead." But he wished now that he had not come in. Yes, Mrs. Esterhazy was in touch with important happenings, and it made him uneasy just to know that, without hearing anything more. Mrs. Esterhazy said,
"There's supposed to be a measure under debate at the UN right now, having to do with anomalous children."
Her voice shook.
"It would require the closing of Camp PG."
After a moment, he was able to say, "But why?" He stared at her.
"They're afraid, well, they don't want to see what they call defective stock appearing on the colonial planets. They want to keep the race pure. Can you understand that? I can, and yet I can't agree. Probably because of my own child. No, I just can't agree. They're not worried about the anomalous children at home because they don't have the aspirations for themselves that they do for us. You have to understand the idealism and anxiety which they have about us. Do you remember how you felt before you emigrated here with your family? Back home, they see the existence of anomalous children on Mars as a sign that one of Earth's major problems has been transplanted into the future, because we are the future to them, and..."
Steiner interrupted her.
"You're certain about this, Bill?" "I feel certain."
She faced him, her chin up, her intelligent eyes calm.
"We can't be too careful. It would be dreadful if they closed Camp BG, and..."
She did not finish. In her eyes, he read something unspeakable. The anomalous children, his boy and hers, would be killed in some scientific, painless, instantaneous way. Did she mean that?
"Say it," he said.
Mrs. Esterhazy said, "The children would be put to sleep." Revolted, he said,
"Killed, you mean?"
"Oh," she said, "how can you speak it like that, as if you didn't care?" She gazed at him in horror.
"Christ," he said with violent bitterness, "if there's any truth in this..."
But he did not believe her. Because perhaps he didn't want to? Because it was too ghastly? No, he thought, because he did not trust her instincts, her sense of reality. She had picked up some garbled hysterical rumor. Perhaps there was a bill directed towards some tangential aspect of this that might affect Camp BG and its children in some fashion. But they, the parents of anomalous children, had always lived under that cloud. They had read of the mandatory sterilization of both parents and offspring in cases where it was proved that the gonads had been permanently altered, generally in cases of exposure to gamma radiation in unusual mass quantity.
"Who in the UN are authors of this bill?" he asked.
"There are 6 members of the In-Planet Health and Welfare Committee who are supposed to have written the bill." She began writing.
"Here are their names. Now, Mr. Steiner, what we'd like you to do is to write to these men and have anybody you know who...
He barely listened. He paid for his flute, thanked her, accepted the folded piece of paper, and made his way out of the gift shop. God damn, how he wished he hadn't gone in there. Did she enjoy telling such stories? Wasn't there enough trouble in the world as it was without old wives' tales being peddled by middle-aged females who should not have had anything to do with public affairs in the first place? But in him a quiet voice said, "She may be right. You have to face it." Gripping his heavy suitcases, he walked on, confused and frightened, hardly aware of the small new shops which he passed as he hurried toward Camp BG and his waiting son. When he entered the great glass-domed solarium of Camp Ben-Gurion, there stood young, sandy-haired Miss Milch in her work smock and sandals, with clay and paint spattered on her, a hectic expression knitting her eyebrows. She tossed her head and pushed her tousled hair back from her face as she came toward him. "Hello, Mr. Steiner. What a day we've had. Two new children and one of them a holy terror." "Miss Milch," he said, "I was talking to Mrs. Esterhazy at her shop just now." "She told you about the supposed bill at the UN?" Miss Milch looked tired. "Yes, there is such a bill. Anne gets every sort of inside piece of news, although how she does it I have no idea. Try to keep from showing any agitation around Manfred if you possibly can. He's been upset by the new arrivals today." She started off to lead Mr. Steiner from the solarium down the corridor to the playroom in which his son would be found, but he hurried after her, halting her. "What can we do about this bill?" he demanded breathlessly. He set down his suitcases, holding now only the paper bag in which Mrs. Esterhazy had put the wooden flute. "I don't know that we can do anything," Miss Milch said. She went on slowly to the door and opened it. The sound of children's voices came shrill and loud to their ears. "Naturally, the authorities at New Israel and back home in Israel itself have made furious protests, and so have several other governments. But so much of this is secret. The bill is secret, and it all has to be done sub rosa so they won't start a panic. It's such a touchy subject. Nobody really knows what public sentiment is on this, or even if it should be listened to." Her voice, weary and brittle, dragged as if she were running down. But then she seemed to perk up. She patted him on the shoulder. "I think the worst they would do once they closed BG is deport the anomalous children back home. I don't think they'd ever go so far as to destroy them." Steiner said quickly, "To camps back on Earth." "Let's go and find Manfred," Miss Milch said. "All right. I think he knows this is the day you come. He was standing by the window. But of course he does that a lot." Suddenly, to his own surprise, he burst out in a choked voice, "I wonder if maybe they might be right. What use is it to have a child that can't talk or live among people?" Miss Milch glanced at him but said nothing. "He'll never be able to hold a job," Steiner said. "He'll always be a burden on society like he is now. Isn't that the truth?" "Autistic children still baffle us," Miss Milch said, "by what they are and how they got that way, and by their tendency to begin to evolve mentally all at once for no apparent reason, after years of complete failure to respond." "I think I can't in good conscience oppose this bill," Steiner said. "Not after thinking it over. Not after the first shock is over. It would be fair. I feel it's fair." His voice shook. "Well," Miss Milch said, "I'm glad you didn't say that to Anne Esterhazy, because she'd never let you go. She'd be after you making speeches at you until you came around to her side." She held open the door to the big playroom. "Manfred is over in the corner." Seeing his son from a distance, Steiner thought, you would never know to look at him. The large, well-formed head, the curly hair, the handsome features. The boy was bent over, absorbed in some object which he held. A genuinely good-looking boy, with eyes that shone sometimes mockingly, sometimes with glee and excitement. And such terrific coordination. The way he sprinted about on the tips of his toes, as if dancing to some unheard music, some tune from inside his own mind, whose rhythms kept him enthralled. We are so pedestrian compared to him, Steiner thought. Leaden. We creep along like snails, while he dances and leaps, as if gravity does not have the same influence on him as it does on us. Could he be made from some new and different kind of atom? "Hi, Manny," Mr. Steiner said to his son. The boy did not raise his head or show any sign of awareness. He continued fooling with the object. I will write to the framers of the bill, Steiner thought, and tell them I have a child in the camp, and that I agree with them. His thoughts frightened him. Murder of Manfred, he recognized it. My hatred of him coming out, released by this news. I see why they're debating it in secret. Many people have this hate, I bet, unrecognized inside. No flute for you, Manny, Steiner said. Why should I give it to you, I wonder? Do you give a damn? No. The boy did not look up or give any indication of hearing. Nothing, Steiner said. Emptiness. While Steiner stood there, tall, slender Dr. Glaub, in his white coat, carrying his clipboard, approached. Steiner became suddenly aware of him and started.
There's a new theory about autism, Dr. Glaub said. From Berghotzlei in Switzerland. I wish to discuss it with you because it seems to offer us a new avenue with your son here.
I doubt it, Steiner said.
Dr. Glaub did not seem to hear him, he continued. It assumes a derangement in the sense of time in the autistic individual, so that the environment around him is so accelerated that he cannot cope with it. In fact, he is unable to perceive it properly, precisely as we would be if we faced a speeded-up television program, so that objects whizzed by so fast as to be invisible and sound was a gobbledygook, you know? Just extremely high-pitched mishmash. Now, this new theory would place the autistic child in a closed chamber where he faced a screen on which filmed sequences were projected slowed down. Do you see? Both sound and video slowed, at last so slow that you and I would not be able to perceive motion or comprehend the sounds as human speech.
Wearily, Steiner said, "Fascinating. There's always something new, isn't there, in psychotherapy?"
Yes, Dr. Glaub said, nodding. Especially from the Swiss. They're ingenious in comprehending the world views of disturbed persons, of encapsulated individuals cut off from ordinary means of communication, isolated, you know?
I know, Steiner said.
Dr. Glaub, still nodding, had moved on to stop by another parent, a woman who was seated with her small girl, both of them examining a cloth picture book.
Hope before the deluge, Steiner thought. Does Dr. Glaub know that any day the authorities back on Earth may close Camp BG? The good doctor labors on in idiotic innocence, happy in his schemes.
Walking after Dr. Glaub, Steiner waited until there was a pause in the conversation, and then he said, "Doctor, I'd like to discuss this new theory a little further."
"Yes, yes," Dr. Glaub said, excusing himself from the woman and her child. He led Steiner over to one side, where they could talk privately.
"This concept of time rates may open a doorway to minds so fatigued by the impossible task of communicating in a world where everything happens with such rapidity that—"
Steiner interrupted. "Suppose your theory works out. How can you help such an individual function? Did you intend for him to stay in the closed chamber with the slowed-down picture screens the rest of his life? I think, Doctor, that you're all playing games here. You're not facing reality. All of you at Camp BG, you're so virtuous, so without guile. But the outside world, it's not like that. This is a noble, idealistic place in here, but you're fooling yourselves. So in my opinion, you're also fooling the patients. Excuse me for saying it. This slowed-down closed chamber, it epitomizes you all here, your attitude."
Dr. Glaub listened, nodding, with an intent expression on his face. "We have practical equipment promised," he said when Steiner had finished. "From Westinghouse, back on Earth, rapport with others in society is achieved primarily through sound. And Westinghouse has designed for us an audio recorder which picks up the message directed at the psychotic individual, for example your boy Manfred, then, having recorded this message on iron oxide tape, replays it almost instantly for him at lower speed, then erases itself and records the next message, and so on, with the result that a permanent contact with the outside world at his own rate of time is maintained. And later we hope to have in our hands here a video recorder which will present a constant but slowed-down record to him of the visual portion of reality, synchronized with the audio portion. Admittedly, he will be one step removed from contact with reality, and the problem of touch presents difficulties. But I disagree when you say this is too idealistic to be of use. Look at the widespread chemical therapy that was tried not so long ago.
Stimulants speeded up the psychotic's interior time sense so that he could comprehend the stimuli pouring in on him. But as soon as the stimulant wore off, the psychotic's cognition slowed down as his faulty metabolism reestablished itself, you know? Yet we learned a good deal from that. We learned that psychosis has a chemical basis, not a psychological basis. 60 years of erroneous notions were upset in a single experiment using sodium amytol.
Dreams, Steiner interrupted. You will never make contact with my boy.
Turning, he walked away from Dr. Glaub. From Camp BG, he went by bus to a swanky restaurant, the Red Fox, which always bought a good deal of his wares. After he had finished his business with the owner, he sat for a time at the bar, drinking a beer. The way Dr. Glaub had babbled on, that was the kind of idiocy that had brought them to Mars in the first place, to a planet where a glass of beer cost twice what a shot of scotch cost, because it had so much more water in it. The owner of the Red Fox, a small, bald, portly man wearing glasses, seated himself next to Steiner and said, "Why are you looking so glum, Norb?" Steiner said, "They're going to close down Camp BG."
"Good," the owner of the Red Fox said. "We don't need those freaks here on Mars. It's bad advertising."
"I agree," Steiner said, "at least to a certain extent."
"It's like those babies with seal flippers back in the 60s. From them using that German drug? They should have destroyed all of them. There's plenty of healthy, normal children born. Why spare those others? If you had a kid with extra arms and no arms, deformed in some way, you wouldn't want it kept alive, would you?"
"No," Steiner said. He did not say that his wife's brother back on Earth was a facomalus, had been born without arms and made use of superb artificial ones designed for him by a Canadian firm which specialized in such equipment. In fact, he said nothing to the little portly man. He drank his beer and stared at the bottles behind the bar. He did not like the man at all and had never told him about Manfred. He knew the man's deep-seated prejudice. Nor was he unusual. Steiner could summon up no resentment toward him. He merely felt weary and did not want to discuss it.
"That was the beginning," the owner said. "Those babies born in the early 60s, are there any of them at Camp BG? I never set foot inside there and I never will."
Steiner said, "How could they be at BG? They're hardly anomalous. Anomalous means one of a kind."
"Oh, yeah," the man admitted. "I see what you mean. Anyhow, if they destroyed them years ago, we wouldn't have such places as BG, because in my mind there's a direct link between the monsters born in the 60s and all the freaks supposedly born due to radiation ever since. I mean, it's all due to substandard genes, isn't it? Now, I think that's where the Nazis were right. They saw the need of weeding out the inferior genetic strains as long ago as 1930. They saw..."
"My son," Steiner began, and then stopped. He realized what he had said. The portly man stared at him.
"My son is there," Steiner at last went on. "He means as much to me as your son does to you. I know that someday he will emerge into the world once more."
"Oh, let me buy you a drink, Norbert," the portly man said, "to show you how sorry I am. I mean about the way I talked."
Steiner said, "If they close BG, it would be a calamity too great for us to bear, we who have children in there. I can't face it."
"I see what you mean," the portly man said. "I understand your feeling."
"You are superior to me if you understand how I feel," Steiner said, "because I can make no sense out of it."